This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Coyotes were long revered by Native Americans, with legends praising their cleverness and cunning. But when white Europeans arrived in the New World and began spreading west, they saw coyotes as a threat to their settlement to the frontier. And so a century-long annihilation campaign began. But amazingly, writes our guest today, the coyotes just kept coming back. Today in The Exchange, naturalist, historian, and author Dan Flores joins us on his latest book, Coyote Nation. And let's hear from you, your questions about coyote habits and your own encounters with them here in New Hampshire. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Also, if you've managed to get a picture of that coyote encounter, post it to our website, nhpr.org/exchange, or on our Facebook page. And Dan Flores, welcome. It's great to have you. Really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, right up front, Dan, why the two pronunciation of this animal's name, coyote and coyote? Now, I said coyote. That's just the way I grew up. But why is that important?
Well, most people on the coast, both East and West Coast, say coyote, and people in the Southwest tend to say coyote as well. But in the hinterland, in the rural Midwest, the rural West, the South, the word is coyote. And I tried to track down in the book how those two different pronunciations emerge, because the truth is this word is actually an Aztec Indian name for the animal. For most of the 19th century, when Americans encountered coyotes, we call them prairie wolves. And that was a name that continued in use until really about 1915 or so. But it had to do with how people visiting the Southwest handle Spanish, really. Some sort of more literary people liked the three-syllable pronunciation they were hearing from the Spanish translation of the Aztec word, which came out as coyote. And so that lingered on the coast. But a lot of rural people, starting with the mountain men who were in the West in the 19th century, evidently thought that sounded a little bit too fancy or pretentious. And so they reduced it to coyote. And a lot of people have heard only that pronunciation.
Well, and you write that it's almost a political question, right? You gave a talk somewhere and the organizers came up to you and said, you really need to say coyote.
Yes, it has become a little bit of a political question. It almost seems, and this is not a hard and fast rule by any means, but it almost seemed to me as I was working on Coyote America that the people who were advocates of the animal, who wanted to protect it and who took pleasure in seeing coyotes, tended to use the three-syllable pronunciation. And as a friend of mine said during the course of my research when I was talking to him about this, he said, you know, anybody who shoots one never calls it a coyote. It's always a coyote if you shoot at it. And so that, as I began noticing, kind of emerged as a little bit of a political divide, that people on one side of the issue of the animal tended to confer a kind of respect for it, I think, by calling it a coyote. And the people who tended to denigrate it often tended to call it coyote.
Well, and you mentioned the Aztecs, Dan, and just to remind us how the Native Americans, North and South America, regarded this animal. I mean, some of them even deified it.
The coyote, in fact, is the animal representation of our oldest deity in North American history, at least the oldest one, the one most distant in time that we've been able to uncover. And probably as far back as 10,000 years ago, Native people in the American West, which was where the coyote evolved and where its range was found 10,000 years ago, decided that of all the animals that were available to them, that this was the animal that to them seemed to be the most avatar-like, the most stand-in for human beings in the world. And so they created this character called Old Man Coyote, and that figure became kind of the deity who created North America, who caused the rivers to flow the way they did, who basically put people in the particular locales where they were found, and hundreds of stories about this character were preserved in the oral tradition of Native peoples from really from present-day Mexico City all the way up into British Columbia. So it's this body of literature that's the oldest literature we have in North America, and it's about this coyote avatar figure who's kind of a stand-in for humans and who the stories teach human beings about human nature. That's really what their function is.
Wow. So of all the animals they could have chosen, you know, bear or, I don't know, eagle or some other majestic animal, they chose the
That's
coyote.
Right. They chose the coyote. And I think, I speculate in the book, I've got a chapter in Coyote America that's called Old Man America, and it's a chapter specifically about this story. And I retell in modern prose four of kind of classic Old Man Coyote stories. And I speculate that the selection of the coyote from all these other creatures that were available had to do with Native people watching the Pleistocene extinctions happen around them when we lost something like 30 or 40 large animals in North America about 10,000 years ago. But they saw this animal that survived that extinction scenario, and I think they identified with its ability to survive. And so the coyote's survival instincts have been holding it in good stead among people for a very long time.
Well, and that's a big theme in this book, Dan, right? I mean, this campaign of annihilation that you write about, and then you summarize it, you say, in the war between humans and coyotes, coyotes have won hands down. So one of the big questions that you explore in this book is, why did Europeans who came here hate coyotes so much for so long?
Well, that's another interesting story in the biography of this animal. I mean, and this biography is more than 5 million years old. Canids come out of an evolutionary background in North America that goes back 5 million years. And, of course, they've been around people for the last 15,000 years when people came from Asia into North America. So it's a long story. And one of the fascinating parts of it is that for much of the coyote's experience with human beings, it's regarded as not only the inspiration for a deity figure, but as this very fascinating animal which tended to not offer up humans any reason to persecute it. So Native people never did chase coyotes to ground or kill them or try to trap them. They simply admired and watched them and tried to learn from them. And then Europeans come along, and what's so intriguing about this part of the story is that Europeans don't have coyotes in the Old World. And so unlike wolves and bears and many other animals, the coyote is not a creature that they have any sort of folklore or traditions about. And so for a lot of the 19th century, after Lewis and Clark described them in 1804, they basically, coyotes are kind of value-free. No one knows exactly what to think about them, although they do look something like wolves, and so that puts them in something of a bad light. But it's through a kind of a process of growing familiarity and experience with them, especially after Mark Twain publishes a very kind of denigrating description of coyotes in his famous book, Roughing It, that we decide that this is an animal that ultimately isn't worth breathing up good American air. And so we do launch in the 20th century this campaign to try to completely annihilate them from the continent. It's a really remarkable story that we try to do something like that.
Well, I mean, the names that people called coyotes during that campaign, Public Enemy Number One, even Bolshevik. I mean, Bolshevik, Dan?
Yeah. The original Bolshevik, yeah. That comes from a story in, of all places, Scientific American in 1920, when a writer basically is describing, this is in about the three decades after Mark Twain had given us this way of thinking about them as these cowardly little wretches. And this particular writer in 1920 says that coyotes are so despicable that they basically should be shot on sight. The problem is they're not worth the ammunition that you need to shoot them down. But he goes on to say, but there's a patriotic reason for shooting them, which means you should go ahead and follow through with it because they are, after all, the original Bolshevik. I mean, of course, this is in the period immediately following the Russian Revolution of 1917 when Bolshevik is this word of opprobrium in America. And so, yeah, this is an animal who in North American history we can simply think of as sort of the original communist and revolutionary. And so let's shoot them on sight.
Well, the exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, and, of course, stories of your own encounters with coyotes is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Contact us there. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So there's this huge campaign, Dan, and, you know, you write about all the poisons and the guns and the, you know, eugenics and, you know, in other words, trying to sterilize coyotes and even helicopter yes. campaigns and so forth. What's amazing to me is that they keep coming back. They keep coming back. How do they do it?
Well, they do it, and I have to say, as sort of a way to bring listeners into this story, Americans began to realize by about 1900 that as successful as we were in eliminating so many North American species, I mean, and so bison have been reduced to a handful of animals by that point. Many other large creatures in the East, the white-tailed deer, amazingly enough, is almost gone. And of course, we were in the process of eradicating wolves in North America, which was pretty much complete by the 1920s. But there were people in America who were noticing that somehow among all these animals that were doing the proper thing and folding up their tents in the face of the advance of civilization, coyotes weren't doing it. And so there's a really wonderful story that was written in, for one of the major American magazines in 1900 by a writer named Ernest Thompson Seton called Tito, the Coyote That Learned How. And it was the story, this allegory that tried to explain why coyotes alone among all these animals seem to survive our persecution. And it's this allegorical story where this little coyote named Tito is captured by a rancher and kept in a yard, chained up to a post, and it sits there. It's a little female coyote, and she observes everything that humans do to try to wipe out coyotes. And at one point in the story, she finally escapes, gets into the wild, finds a mate, has a litter of pups, and then teaches that litter and, Seton argues, all other coyotes after that how to avoid all of humankind's traps and poisons and attempts to wipe coyotes out. And he ends the story by basically saying she's the coyote Moses. She's like Moses, raised among the Egyptians as an Israelite who learns all their tricks and is able to lead the Israelites into freedom. And so we have this allegorical story, but the truth that biologists have come up with is that the success of the animal isn't really due to there being some hero coyote like Tito who taught them how to react to human pressure, but it has to do with their evolution and the fact that they have a number of evolutionary adaptations that enable them to, when they're pressured, to actually produce larger litters of pups and to colonize widely across the landscape. And so, ironically enough, the more we tried to pressure them, the more the end result was that coyotes spread out of the American West across the South, across the East, until the point now where they are in every single state in the United States except for Hawaii.
So they're so amazingly adaptable that when their populations are pressured, the females respond by actually producing larger litters of pups, kind of saying, take this.
They do, indeed.
That's amazing, really, when you think about it.
It is, and it has to do with their evolution alongside gray wolves. And so it's not an adaptation to us, actually. It's something that they're able to use when the persecutor becomes us rather than wolves. But gray wolves and coyotes are long and inveterate enemies. And so the coyote evolved this ability in the face of persecution and harassment by the larger canid that was in the North American landscape. And once we came along and eliminated the gray wolves, but then turned our own persecution against coyotes, they were able to call on these evolutionary adaptations in order to survive what we could throw at them.
And sometimes these litters are quite large, you say, Dan, like 19 pups. I mean,
yes,
it's an amazing
response.
Yes,
they'll have as many as the normal litter size is about 5 to 6 pups. And the way coyote demographics work is that when they're not harassed, and we know this from places like Yellowstone National Park, for example, where after wolves were eliminated from the park in the 1920s, there was a period of about 70 years or so before we reintroduced gray wolves into Yellowstone in the mid-1990s. So we had an opportunity to study what happened with coyotes during that period. And when they're not harassed, their numbers basically rise to the level of the carrying capacity of the landscape, and then they don't go any higher. They just settle into a kind of an equilibrium. And at that point, they will often have litters of only 3 or 4 pups, and sometimes they can't get more than 1 or 2 of them to adulthood. But whenever you eliminate the coyote population in the landscape, which they are able to perceive, by the way, by howling and by hearing answering howls. And when they don't hear answering howls, they sense that the coyote population is lower, and that produces a hormonal effect. And that causes the litters sometimes to go up to as many as 12, 14, and the record so far is 19 pups born to a single female. And that's a way, of course, of rebuilding their populations. And so they have this remarkable ability.
Is that partly what the howl is about, Dan? Checking out the neighborhood, seeing how many other coyotes are around?
That's certainly one of the functions of it. It's kind of a census taking. But, I mean, we don't really know what all their vocalizations mean. They obviously are communicating in a fairly sophisticated way. But, of course, you know, the howl, the coyote howl is one of the great features of North American history. It's, I argue in the book, it's kind of the original national anthem of America.
Well, heading into a break, Dan, then let's listen to a group of coyotes howling. And when we come back, we'll start taking your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the amazing story of what our guest calls an American icon, the coyote. We're talking with author, professor, and historian Dan Flores. His brand new book is called Coyote America. Let's get your questions and, of course, your stories of your own encounters with coyotes, if you've seen them in the woods, in the fields, or in your own backyard. Dan, by the way, calls them the wolf in our backyard. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan, lots of commentary on Facebook from our listeners. Rebecca says, yesterday morning, coming up our barn road, following our German Shepherd, when I called him inside, nearly the size of him, who is a 3-year-old male. So Rebecca saw a coyote following her German Shepherd. Is that a little worrisome, Dan?
Well, you know, I would say that we certainly have to make sure in modern coyote America, where everybody across the country is now living with coyotes, we have to make sure that we protect our pets, because coyotes establish territories in both rural and urban areas, and they defend those territories. So a lot of the friction that develops between coyotes and cats and dogs has to do with the coyote regarding our pets as kind of interlopers in their territories, predators, if you will. So I would say that having one follow your dog is not a particularly unusual thing. They're curious about dogs. I mean, they evolved with wolves alongside them, and so they often tend to think of large dogs, especially like her German Shepherd probably, as potentially a wolf. And my guess is that was probably curiosity that made that coyote follow behind the dog. But so yeah, you want to make sure to protect your animals.
So don't worry about maybe your German Shepherd, but how about your Chihuahua?
Well, I mean, Chihuahuas and small dogs can certainly be snatched, and they're except during the season when coyotes are whelping pups, which is in the summer. Pets that are grabbed are usually not eaten. They're often just killed as competitors. But sometimes during the whelping season, when there are pups to feed and coyote pairs are ranging far and wide trying to come up with enough protein for those little ones, they will sometimes take a cat or a small dog to a den to feed their pups.
Well, and here's a Facebook comment from Brian. He says, I've seen a few very large ones in my area. They follow me as I mow my fields. Melissa says she saw one last week in Milford. Allegra says there are some, not sure how many, that can be heard in the near distance lots of nights on conservation land off my street in Hollis. And Jen, just so you know, Hollis is sort of a lovely suburban area. She says, heard them vocalizing just overnight on Sunday. So thanks for those Facebook comments. That one from Brian, they follow me as I mow my fields. There's another story of a coyote following someone. You've got a story like that in your book too, Dan.
I do. I've got a couple of stories in the book about experiences that I've had, and I have had many others that I didn't write about where, I mean, they're curious, and they also have spent thousands and thousands of years around humans without having to fear us. And so it's been a fairly quick and easy step for them to sort of take our measure and be nonchalant around us. And I think in some respects, that alarms people. They expect that when you see a wild animal, its instinct is going to be to turn and run as hard as it can to get away. But coyotes spent so many thousands of years being admired by native people, and only, after all, maybe 125 years being persecuted, that they very quickly sort of are able to exist around us without being too alarmed. And so they're curious. I mean, I've had them sit in my yard and watch me as I did construction on my house. And I mean, they sat there just and cocked their heads back and forth. They were absolutely fascinated at what I was doing with hammers and drills.
It's kind of unsettling, though, for folks. You know, again, Brian being followed as he mows his fields and you being watched as you hammer nails.
Yeah, I didn't find it unsettling because I've spent most of my life around coyotes. I mean, they were colonizing Louisiana when I was growing up, and I've lived in the West, in Montana and West Texas and New Mexico for all my adult life, and there have been coyotes around all the time. So it's just been, to me, having coyotes available to watch and observe it's like getting to watch whales breach in the ocean, or getting to, as I say in the book, getting to look through your telescope and see the Galilean moons around Jupiter. on a winter night. It's one of the great aspects of nature that we get to observe. But for a lot of people, I will admit, who aren't used to seeing them, the first reaction is usually alarm. But I don't think you have to be too alarmed. We want to keep them wild. We don't want to let them get too comfortable being close in around us, and we definitely want to protect our animals. But it's just a little bit of behavioral modification on our parts, and we can quite easily coexist with these remarkable small wolves in our backyards.
Well, I definitely want to ask you a little bit later, Dan, about concerns about keeping them wild as they show up, you know, on the Portland, Oregon subway or in Central Park and so forth. But let's go to our listeners. And again, the number for you to join us today in the exchange, as we talk about coyotes in America and their pretty amazing adaptation to living around humans, 1-800-892-6477. You can also post pictures to our website. We'd love that, or our Facebook page. John's calling in from Bridgewater. Hey, John, you're in the exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Sure, go ahead.
I've hunted all my life in New Hampshire, up and down the whole state, and I've seen coyotes a lot. And the real reason why hunters and a lot of people disdain them is the way they kill. They attack, they mostly kill the skippers in the box, in the big box, and this is why. They'll take the baby skippers and they run them down and they'll hold them down. They grab their neck, and if they can't break their neck, they start eating them alive.
Yikes.
And I've even come onto baby skippers that were alive and had their haunches and innards. They start from the back because they eat the guts out and that rots first, and then they kill. They'll kill as many as they can.
Hey, John, what's a skipper?
Oh, a skipper, I'm sorry, is a baby.
A baby deer?
Yeah, a skipper's like a fawn.
Yeah, so that's why some people don't like coyotes. They see them as cruel killers, John. That seems to be what you're saying?
Right. Well, for that one respect, they kill the babies, and then the bucks will stop and fight them. And what will happen is when the bucks thrash around with their horns, the coyotes will Achilles them. They'll nip at their back of their legs until they get them to bleed, and then they'll chase them down and kill them.
Wow.
So that's another reason, because they attack the babies and the alpha bucks. So hunters get a real disdain for them. Even though it's God's will, they have to eat, you know?
Yeah, but it's not pretty to watch, and that's kind of how most predators work, right, Dan? They attack the small, the weak, the sick in any herd first?
Yeah, well, I mean, in the case of coyotes in particular, I mean, this is, after all, an animal, even the eastern coyote, which is larger than the western version. I mean, this is an animal that usually is only somewhere around 35 or 40 pounds. So they're too small to really bring down full-grown animals. And so their prey of large ungulates like white-tailed deer usually is the fawns. But I mean, I would say that, yeah, this is how predators kill. And so when you observe wolves in Yellowstone National Park today, which I have done on numerous occasions, I mean, the running down of the prey and the capitulation of the animal that's overwhelmed by a pack of wolves is not a particularly lovely thing to observe, but it's how nature works. It's the same way that that cheetahs, for example, run down impala in Africa, which we watch on our nature programming all the time. So this is just the North American version of it. And what I would also add to the story that John told us here is that this, after all, has been going on in North America for millions of years, long before we ever arrived here. And so the animals, the prey animals of predators like coyotes and wolves, long ago evolved their own adaptive ability to survive predation. Otherwise, when we arrived 500 years ago, there wouldn't have been any deer or any elk. There would have been nothing but predators left. But in fact, this has been a natural balance that's occurred in North American history for many thousands and, in fact, millions of years. And so it's what's happening as coyotes are replacing wolves in the eastern woodlands is that we're simply sort of reviving an ancient kind of predator prey relationship that's been around really forever, and we're getting to see it now.
Well, John, I appreciate the call. It's definitely not fun to watch, as you said. And Erin is in Barnstead. Hi, Erin, you're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I know that there's a lot of backyard homesteaders and a lot of farming in the community, and I'm also on a lot of social media threads, so I know coyotes have wreaked a lot of havoc on people's farms. We actually just brought on a livestock guardian dog, and she's a purebred Great Pyrenees, and we've been using her in sort of a natural way of, you know, she's not there to attack the wildlife. She more or less uses her size and bark as an intimidation factor, and we found that to be really progressive for us, and I've shared it with a lot of people, and this is a new concept, like, oh, I wasn't familiar with this, and it's a sort of farming technique that's been used for hundreds of years.
What kind of animals were you trying to protect, Erin, from coyotes?
Well, we have chickens, we have pigs, and rabbits.
Yeah, well, I'm sure coyotes love chickens and rabbits, at least, yeah. So, Erin, had you seen threats from coyotes, or are you just worried about it?
No, we've physically seen them. They've been very brave. We used to allow our chickens kind of free range, and it was about mid-noon, and there were four of us out in the field, and sure enough, the chickens started screaming and flying around, and we saw this coyote. I mean, he must not have even known we were there, and came right out of the woods with one of our chickens in his mouth.
Wow.
So, I mean, that was pretty close for us. So,
yeah.
You know, we hear them at night. We see the tracks. We've had some logging done, and our loggers were taking photos of some of the coyotes in our yard. So we're just trying to be proactive on how are we going to handle it, because if we're not home, we can't physically be there to protect our livestock.
Right. Well, Erin, wow, what a story. And thank you so much for calling in. And let's hear another one. This is Richard in New London. Go ahead, Richard.
Yes. I was doing canoe camping in Kemagami, Canada. And we had bunked down after a portage and was sleeping. And in the morning, I heard this noise. And I looked up, and there was a coyote in our campsite. So I reached out of my sleeping the business there and grabbed an old piece of French toast and threw it to the coyote. And he grabbed it in his mouth, and so help me, in his front paws, he bowed and then turned around and ran away. And in 5 minutes, I heard a howl of thanks.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you're lucky he didn't come back for more, Richard, right?
That's right.
Or with five of his best friends. Yeah.
And we didn't see him again. We kept our camping going.
Oh, that's a great story. Thank you so much for calling in, Richard. And, you know, on this issue of hunting and predator-prey balance and so forth, here's an email, Dan, from Courtney, who says, my husband and I recently moved to York, Maine. We've been hearing coyotes in our woods for a few weeks. We have neighbors who have asked to hunt the coyotes, saying that if they go unchecked, they will kill all of the deer and wild turkeys on our land. Courtney says, my feeling is, in most cases, predators should not be hunted as they serve an integral role in population balance. However, I do not want to see all the deer and turkeys on our land completely disappear. Courtney says she'd appreciate your thoughts and advice. Thank you, Courtney, for the email.
Well, those are, I mean, all three of those, Erin's, Richard's, and Courtney's stories have all been really excellent. And I'd just like to say something about all three of them. As for Courtney's email, I would say that, you know, to go back to what I iterated a few minutes ago, predator-prey relationships are millions of years old in North America. And so the deer, I can assure her, are not going to disappear on her land. The wild turkeys are not going to disappear either. These are animals that have developed abilities to survive with predation. And so they're not going to disappear. I mean, we've sort of promulgated that idea ever since the beginning of the 20th century, when we argued that if we got rid of all the predators, then there would be more deer to shoot and more elk to shoot, and sportsmen would have more animals to hunt. But the truth is these animals, the prey base in particular, the deer and the turkeys, are used to this kind of cropping, and they have their own adaptive and evolutionary abilities to survive it. So I don't think anyone is going to have to worry about that. We're just restoring. What's happening with coyotes coming in to the east is that we're restoring a kind of a natural balance that was always there with the wolf population that was in the east. As for the, I think it was Aaron's account of using a Great Pyrenees, that is a really terrific and progressive way to take on protecting your livestock from predators. It's something, and I would encourage people in the east and the south to think about this. People in the west have been living with coyotes basically from the beginning. And so this is the kind of thing that in the West, progressive people in particular have been doing for a very long time. And they do it employing animals like guard dogs to protect livestock, for instance. And people in the West have been doing it because they recognize what we're all going to have to come to terms with, which is simply that resistance is really futile in this instance. We're not going to be able to get rid of coyotes. We've never been able to get rid of them, no matter how many poisons and how many helicopter attacks we've tried. We can't get rid of them. And so what you have to do is simply learn how to coexist. And that requires a little bit of behavior modification and being smart about things. But it also means that you don't have to kill every single predator that you see. You just figure out ways to protect your farmstead and your animals, and then you enjoy having these original North American symbols of the wild on your place.
Because they're
they're
not.
Yeah,
I want to
say one other thing about Richard's story, and just one little brief thing. That's a wonderful story with the French toast and the coyote bowing and giving thanks with a howl. And it reminds me of the first European who gave an account of coyotes. He was a Spanish writer in the 16th century. And one of the things he said was that it was well known among the people of the countryside, and he was mostly referring to native people, that coyotes remembered when you did well by them. And if you did well by them, they would return that in kind over time. So I think by tossing that piece of French toast to his coyote, he's got a coyote out there who's going to be looking at his back and taking care of him.
Well, but you shouldn't feed wild animals, right? I mean, that's the message that we always get.
The message for sure in towns and around your homestead is that you don't feed animals human food. And the reason you don't, of course, is because it habituates them to thinking that we're a source of food, and it will bring them ever closer into where you live. Now, on a camping trip out in the wilds somewhere, tossing a coyote a piece of French toast is probably not going to do any harm.
That's a great story. Coming up, how Walt Disney himself started a pro-coyote movement in the United States in the early 1960s. We'll find out about that in just a minute. And we'll hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new look at an animal that has thrived despite more than a century of efforts to eradicate it, the coyote. Our guest is Dan Flores. He's a professor emeritus of Western history at the University of Montana. In addition to the book we're talking about today, Coyote America, he's the author of 10 books on aspects of the American West. You can join us with your stories, comments, questions on coyotes, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Also, if you have pictures of any encounters with coyotes, we'd like to see them. Post a photo on our Facebook page or on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Dan, let's go right back to our listeners. And Peter's in Merrimack. Hi, Peter. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I was just wondering what your guest comment had about coy dogs.
Coy dogs and what I've also heard Peter called coy wolves. I'm so glad you called, Peter, because this is an important point. And you talk about this in the book towards the end, Dan, this interbreeding of coyotes with other species.
Yes, it's a really intriguing story, too, because one of the things that makes it so intriguing is that it only happens in the East and South. It does not happen in the West, and so that's created a puzzle for biologists. And what the story seems to be, without going into a huge amount of detail, is that gray wolves that are found were found in the West and are, of course, being reintroduced into the West in our own time, are animals that have an enmity towards coyotes. And so we have no evidence, even at the point when gray wolves are being reduced to a few remnants and we're looking for mates among ranch dogs in the 1920s, they weren't interbreeding with coyotes. But for some reason, and I'll try to explain why we think this is the case, coyotes have interbred with the remnant wolf populations of the East, especially in eastern Canada, and they did so also when there were viable populations of wild red wolves in the South. Coyotes interbred with them. And the reason we think they interbreeding or creating this coy wolf animal in the East and the South and haven't done so in the West is because Eastern and Southern wolves actually come from a very close evolutionary relationship with coyotes. Biologists say that they only probably separated these Eastern and Southern wolves and coyotes in an evolutionary sense about 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. And so by contrast, the distance, the evolutionary distance between coyotes and gray wolves is much larger. Those animals then have over time achieved a kind of a barrier to reproductive success between gray wolves and coyotes. But these Eastern and Southern wolves are much closer in time to coyotes, and there are no behavioral distances between having them mate with one another. And so we're kind of creating, in effect, a new animal in eastern North America, which has about 15% wolf genes, probably about 65 to 70% coyote genes, and some domestic dog genes along the way, too. It's kind of a Canis soup of dogs, wolves, and coyotes.
Well, what is the difference between a pure coyote, if I could put it that way, and one of these hybrids in terms of, you know, appearance or behavior?
Well, the eastern coyote, or the coy wolf as some people refer to it, is a slightly larger animal. It's maybe 7 or 8 pounds heavier instead of having a 30 or 35-pound grown male. Eastern coyotes may get up to as large as 42, 43 pounds. Eastern coyotes tend to hunt in packs a good bit more than the animals do in the West, which is probably something that they acquired as a result of their wolf genetics. But they have and they're able to bring down deer better than coyotes can because they're larger and they, as I said, they have this wolf inclination to hunt in packs. But the animals also have the cleverness and the intelligence of coyotes. And so what we have as a result is an animal that's probably not going to be nearly as easily extirpated from the landscape as gray wolves were. Gray wolves were fairly easy for us to eliminate from the landscape because their packing instinct is so strong. If you could kill one animal out of a pack and use its scent, you could generally kill every other animal in the pack, draw them in with the scent of the first one that you kill. But coyotes they have this adaptation called fission fusion, where they can fuse together and form packs, but they also can fission. In other words, they separate as singles and pairs, and so they're not as tightly bound by pack instincts. And that's one of the ways they've, in fact, been able to survive our persecution.
Well, yet another example, Dan, of their incredible ability to adapt to any circumstance. You know, here's a Facebook comment from Allison related to Peter's question. And Peter, thank you so much for calling. Allison says, I saw a coyote this morning in my paddock with my three horses. I watched it for a while because I thought it was my 100-pound German Shepherd walking around. I went downstairs, and my dog was actually inside. So Allison says, how large are coyotes? Was this a hybrid? And sounds like maybe it was, Allison. Thank you for the comment. You know, you mentioned earlier this idea of predator-prey and how with the elimination of, largely elimination of wolves in this country, coyotes have stepped in to fill the balance. It's interesting, you know, most of us seem to understand this these days, Dan, but not that long ago, you write, people really didn't understand the importance of predators. And then there are a couple amazing stories in the book. I mean, the north rim of the Grand Canyon, they basically eliminated wolves, they eliminated mountain lions, they poisoned 8,000 coyotes. Pretty much all the predators are gone. This is in the 1920s when people started, you know, looking at this. What happened after they basically got rid of all the predators?
Well, there was an eruption of deer, of mule deer, that grew so large over the span of about a decade's time that the deer browsed all the trees and all the vegetation up to the point where even standing on their hind legs, they couldn't reach the browse any longer. And the result was this tremendous collapse and die-off over a period of a couple of winters in the 1920s on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. It's a very famous story, and it's one of the stories that caused American biologists who, I mean, you have to remember that ecology as a science was brand new in the early 20th century, and the American Ecological Society only formed in 1915, so it was only a decade old. And everybody, all these early scientists sort of had gone along with the standard notion of the 19th century that if you eliminate all the predators, then everything is going to be wonderful. It's going to be like these Elysian fields of grazing wild ungulate animals. And they're observing by the 1920s that's not how it worked. And it really started American ecologists into their first investigation of the role of predators in nature's economy. So that event and a couple of others in the 20s were kind of breakthrough events, and it set the scientific community against the idea of eradicating predators like wolves and coyotes. And the scientists fought against this all during the period of the 30s and 40s.
It was kind of too late for the wolves at that point, wasn't it? Or
it was, although what the scientists did get, the one concession they got, really, was that America's national parks would also preserve habitat for predators. And at the time, it meant only coyotes and mountain lions, grizzly bears, and things like that in the West. But it set us up by the 1990s for being able to reintroduce gray wolves into our parks in the West.
Well, there's another story in the book about Kern County, California, after a mass coyote poisoning created a rodent population explosion that made it absolutely just almost impossible to drive down the highway. There were so many rodents. So that's another example. We won't do that one now because it's kind of gross. But you write, Dan, about when, you know, the scientific community starts to realize that these predators are important. And then the public kind of gets on board. And there's a personal story for you. You're a kid. It's 1961. And you're watching TV. And who better than Walt Disney comes on TV? And what does he say to you, Dan?
Well, so, yeah, I'm like 12, 13 years old. And I was a great fan, as many of us were in those days, of what became Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. It was called Walt Disney Presents in its first form. Man, I was sitting in front of the television watching one of these episodes in 1961, and Walt Disney himself walks out in front of the cameras and says he's going to introduce this new film that Disney Productions has, and he calls it The Coyote's Lament. And he says it's going to tell the story of what happened between people and coyotes, not from the Mark Twain perspective, which is the human point of view, but from the coyote's point of view. And I sat and watched this program, and by the end of it, I, and I know millions of other Americans, we became the first generation, I think, of Americans to have our aesthetic, our nature aesthetic, shaped by programming on television.
Well, a book was born back in 1961. I was fascinated by that story, so we went back and we found The Coyote's Lament from that 1961 Walt Disney Presents, where, as you said, it's a funny animated kids program telling the story of westward expansion from the coyote's point of view. But at that point, Dan, public opinion, and there's this emerging environmental consciousness, people started to say, hey, wait a minute, stop picking on the coyotes.
It really did happen that way. I mean, what was required, I think, we had the scientific community already weighing in on the story that we should not be trying to eradicate these animals as we had done with wolves. But it really took the public, some change in the public perception of the animals. And I think it really kind of took popular culture to do it in the form of Walt Disney's films. He did five more pro-coyote films through the 1970s. And, of course, we all had at the same time Wile E. Coyote, this cartoon avatar of human beings on television who, in his endless and obsessive pursuit of the Roadrunner, kind of, you know, reproduces much of the angst of and humiliation of human life. And by the way, along the way, he teaches us how to be careful consumers of American products, because, as you recall from those cartoons, the Acme Corporation provides him with endless devices to catch the Roadrunner, none of which work. So it kind of took, I think, popular culture in a way to change our perception. And it did so, so that by 1972, responding to that pressure, Richard Nixon actually issued a presidential proclamation ending the use of poisons against coyotes on the public lands of the country. And the following year, Congress passed the Endangered Species Act, which meant that coyotes could never again be targeted as an animal we were going to eradicate from the continent.
Well, Walt Disney show that you mentioned, it's great. And we did post it on our website if you want to check it out. It's really entertaining. And Eric actually posted a photo of a coyote on our Facebook page. He says, here's a coyote photographed in June on the Hancock Wildlife Cam. Wow, I didn't even know Hancock had a wildlife cam. Thank you, Eric. And you can post your photos, too, on our Facebook page if you want. And again, we're going to post that Walt Disney video to our website. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Here's Cole in North Conway, who sent us an email. He says, I live in North Conway but grew up in Southern California. Coyotes are an everyday part of life in California, learning to adapt and prosper alongside man. They are not a problem, except to house cats, not quick enough to escape. Here in New Hampshire, Cole says, many people are apprehensive, thinking the coyotes are going to take over and change the natural order. He says that has not been the case in the West. Coyotes are adapters, not changers. Cole says, I do hear them on a fairly regular basis. They make much more noise than their Western cousins after a kill. A different howl, too. Just to let you know, Dan, North Conway is in New Hampshire's beautiful White Mountains. So that's where Cole is. Real interesting to hear him talk about the differences, not just between Western and Eastern coyotes, but Western and Eastern people. I wonder what you think.
Well, I appreciate Cole sending that in. And that's a beautiful place where he lives. I've hiked in the White Mountains. That's a great, great part of of New England. You know, I would say I actually wrote an op-ed in the L.A. Times a few weeks ago about how California should end this age of coyote America, with coyotes showing up and, to be sure, alarming people in lots of places that haven't had to deal with coyotes before, that we need to look to California as the teacher of how to coexist with these animals. I mean, it's not that the California story hasn't had its ups and downs. There have been times when California overreacted to coyotes in downtown Los Angeles, for instance. But California is probably, once again, our teacher in how to coexist with these animals, because they basically have had to do it from the very beginning, from the founding of California's cities, because coyotes were there. And they were a part of the urban experience in California, even back in the 19th century. So I think he's exactly right about that.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for being with us. A lot more we could have talked about, but thanks a lot for being with us this hour. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I've enjoyed it immensely. Thank you, Laura.
Dan Flores, he's Professor Emeritus of Western History at the University of Montana. In addition to Coyote America, he's the author of 10 books on aspects of the American West. And again, remember, our conversation always continues online, on Facebook, and at nhpr.org. And check out the coyote pictures that Eric and others posted there. Post your own as well. We'd love to see them. And if you want to watch that Walt Disney coyote video, we've got it on our website as well. It's nhpr.org/exchange. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Graham. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.